I think we can all agree Peter Rowan has become. He is a legend from his days as a bluegrass boy with all of the other bands and music that he's played. Olden in the Way, he's covered it all. Peter has a brand new album out on Rebel Records. The name of the album is Carter Stanley's Eyes. And as the title evokes, this is an album that contains a lot of the old feel from when Peter was first learning bluegrass with Bill Monroe and his affection for the Stanley Brothers and Carter Stanley. Wonderful album. We're going to have the first part of our visit with the one and only Peter Rowan. You're going to enjoy this a lot. Very happy to welcome to Unreal Bluegrass Peter Rowan. How are you, Peter?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, it's springtime. Easter was beautiful, and the season is beginning with the Merle Watson Festival over in North Carolina. A few weeks, and then we'll be into the heat of the summer with Telluride and Rocky Grass and Gray Fox and all the good festivals that I still get a chance to play.
It never stops for you, does it, Peter?
Well, the thing is, when you're in the music world, there's one rule that you live by that is both a blessing and a sort of a curse in a way. That one rule is never turn down work.
That's a good one.
You know, it's like, be careful what you wish for, right? you could be sitting around in the cold of winter with nothing to do.
You are.
Kind of go, I wish I had some work.
You're right. And Peter, let me tell you this. The listeners of this program, they've heard a lot of your music from all different bands all over the years, and they know that you bring a lot to the music. You borrow a lot from other music, that you're still loyal and true to these bluegrass roots. So I don't need to go over the entire history of Peter Rowan and bluegrass music, although I think it's fascinating. And I want you to take the opportunity to fill in some gaps for me. But I will tell you this. I had Robert Earl Keen on the show when he released Happy Prisoner. And I love Robert Earl Keen. And you sing on that. And there's a little tiny snippet of a story about the Walls of Time, and it's you and Bill Monroe, and you're telling, and then you and Robert Earl go ahead and sing the song. And I just figure there must be about a million little stories that you could tell along the way if someone could find the right little probes to bring them out. It must be an endless, all the things that you've seen and witnessed with Bill Monroe and then Stanley's that we're going to talk about in Carter in a minute, but I just can't imagine if there's any way to pull them all out.
I can't either. I'm trying to myself get it into a book form.
Are you really?
Yeah. These stories of the road and, well, just sort of a more of a musical biography than, anything else. Because it's been the music that has been the spark point. It's kept me interested.
Well, it leads into a good, it's not the first cut on the album, but the title cut. Carter Stanley's Eyes. That's actually a song that kind of ties into a little bit of your connection with Bill Monroe, and it's a great song, but you also tell a story about it, and kind of leads to the album and the whole tone of the album and the selections you've made for it. I know that's one that you wrote. And it's, first of all, let me tell you this. I've been enjoying the heck out of this album since I got it.
I'm glad. Yeah, it's all just live cuts. There's no... I think there's maybe a couple of verses that I sang again to get a little more focused. But everything on that album is live, and I think it sounds like, you've got that way down in the valley kind of gospel thing where we're all standing around one microphone. And then you've got, the wonderful spontaneous playing. I mean, Blaine Sprouse, that was how it went down. Those fiddle parts are exactly how it went down. You didn't go in and redo nothing. Patrick Sauber on the mandolin, that's just, on the banjo, mm-hmm. Just sparkling,
You have a lot of great players with you.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my approach for years, though, just trying to allow people to have their freshness of what they do. I've worked with a lot of people that they're well known now and stuff, but gosh, I mean, they would redo their parts, to satisfy themselves, and I guess that's fair, right, to the musicianship of somebody. But, I think music sounds at its finest when it just sort of flows, and doesn't have to be that clean. You know, it can be a mistake or two, you know, as long as it's played with passion. And I suppose that's why some people want to overdub, is they can't get it on the first take. But to me, it always what most people do sounds good on the first take. But, you know, that's the way recording is nowadays. Everybody wants, you know, everybody goes in and tries to make their part better. And to me, I don't know, it sounds a little funny. But
well, I mean, I think what you're saying is that effort to make it perfect might take some of that organic feel out of what the original recording
was. Yeah, you've got to have a little mud dripping on the
roof. Yeah, that's right. Let's get the name of the album is Carter Stanley's Eyes on Rebel Records, and it's not. Let's make this clear, and I think you make this clear in your song selection. This is not a cover. Let's cover Carter Stanley or Stanley Brothers. There are a lot of songs from those two folks. There's a lot of songs from that era. There are new songs, but there's a feel or a tone about all of these songs. Even the Lead Belly song, the Alabama Bound, that still fits within that same tone.
Yeah, yeah, I like that tone. You know, it's
a feeling.
A feel more than it is that can be described. And, you know, although I had done a lot of shows with the Stanley Brothers when I was a bluegrass boy, I mean, we're talking some years ago. And, 50 years ago now.
Wow.
And still, you know, that musical energy, you know, inspiration is still there. And since I'm a writer, really, a songwriter, trying to broaden my palate, but I had written down all these things that took place when I was a bluegrass boy. You know, I ended up being Bill's everything, driver, guitar player, lead singer, road manager, booking agent, and even at one point was sort of his manager, but I had no idea what that was all about. It meant do everything. And it meant make mistakes. But it was part of my history with Bill to not only support it musically, but to try and just put my whole life into it at the time. And I guess it made me come away with more of insights into things than I would have if I was just a guy riding along waiting for the next show. And, you know, I mean, you had to drive that bus, man. You had to, you know, one guy'd be driving like Jimmy Monroe. He'd be driving. And the only way that bus worked was you get to the top of the hill and throw that seven gears into neutral. And then the one driver jumps out of the driver's seat. And the next driver jumps into the driver's seat while it's in neutral going over the top of the hill. And then you got to make sure that the flywheel, you know, in those days, every gear had a system of gears. You had to get a flywheel, it was called, up to speed with the RPMs of the gear that it's going to be when you get in. So you wouldn't want to go into, like, although you occasionally would make a mistake and go into a lower gear, but you're in seventh, and then you flash it into neutral. The new driver jumps in. Now he needs to have the bus brake a little bit. So, you know, it's a very touchy, kind of a perfection, really, where it's a free fall. The bus is in neutral. There's nobody behind the wheel. And then the new guy jumps behind the wheel, double clutches, and gets the flywheel up to sixth gear, and then... If he's lucky, he'll get it on the first try right into gear. And that's a great feeling in one of those old buses. Now you've got a little bit of braking going on with the engine. But,
Peter, you said at one point there's nobody behind the wheel during this dance.
Well, right, because the one driver just jumped out from behind the wheel.
Okay.
The next guy's got his hands on the wheel, and he jumps into the seat.
Okay.
So there's this exchange. While it's in neutral going over the top of the hill. Now, because it's over the top of the hill, you've got momentum of the bus, and you've got, you know, you can get it up to gear to the speed that you're in, right? In other words, you're not, like, trying to slow it down to nothing.
Right, right.
You're going 45 to 55 miles an hour in this old, you know, flexible flyer. And, and I mean, you just had to do that. That was how it was. The only guy I ever saw was smart enough to get out of it was my buddy Richard Green. And when And when Bill said, "Richard, it's your turn," he just said, "Bill, I don't have a license."
And I'm surprised Bill Monroe took that excuse, actually.
Yeah, but see, Bill respected people who could take command of a situation, even if it wasn't true. Because what's worse than not having him drive is having to confront him as a liar.
Oh. Yeah, I would. You're right. You're right.
Fair enough. You don't have a license.
If Richard had a license, you better destroy it at that point.
But, you know, Richard tickled Bill a lot because Richard was very adventuresome as a fiddle player. And for the first month or so that he worked, except for his solos where he was allowed to cut loose, Bill had him chopping rhythm, you know, basically playing what Bill was playing behind the songs. And whatever backup Richard was going to do, which, you know, fiddle backup in bluegrass, especially the Chubby Wise tradition of the Monroe sound, you know, that's a huge thing. And Richard, you know, he wanted to do that. But, you know, being that he was overly qualified. Oh, and we would hang out with Scotty Stoneman when we got back to Nashville. And of course, you know, Scotty was just the wildest fiddler. He's like, I'm going to say pyrotechnics, but really psychedelia. He was, we'd all heard Hendrix by then. And, you know, Scotty Stoneman just, he was the guy in bluegrass that went all the way out there to his great suffering in the end.
Oh, yeah. Peter, talking about Scotty Stoneman, because I've made a note about you mentioned him in some of the notes here. Do you think there's going to be a time, and you're speaking about him, and I've only because I've talked enough to Ronnie Stoneman to really look into it again for myself, and she talked about Scotty. Do you think we're going to get to the point where even as musicians, you can appreciate all the stuff that he was doing? You clearly did, but Scotty Stoneman was not just out there. He was a remarkable musician. I mean, he really was phenomenal.
Yeah. One of my first encounters with Scotty's music was when I left. I was up at college at Colgate University, and I had made friends with Jack Tottle, wonderful mandolin player,
yeah,
down in Virginia. And my first journey to the D.C. area, which was, you know, rich with bluegrass at that time, Smiley Hobbs and Earl Taylor was around, coming in from Ohio. Mm-hmm. Country Gentlemen were there. And all the people that played with the Country Gentlemen, whose names slip my mind now, beyond Eddie Adcock, John Duffy, and Tom Gray, there were alumni of that band. And also Buzz Busby was still around.
Yeah.
And you know, I had heard Scotty's music as a kid up in Boston when Jack Clemens, who produced a whole lot of Shaking Going On for Jerry Lee Lewis, had a band with Buzz Busby and Scotty Stoneman, and they played up in Boston at a show on the radio called the Hayloft Jamboree. And Buzz, you know, we still do one of his songs in Old and in the Gray. We do Lost, and I heard Scotty and Jack Clemens, unbelievably, on the radio in Boston before Jack went to Memphis and cut a whole lot of Shaking Going On, which was a, you know, huge hit for Jerry Lee.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Scotty, those guys got around, and Scotty and Buzz were around D.C. when I first went down there. And when I got to Jack Tottle's house, Jack picked me up, I think, at a train or a bus, and he just kind of gave me his record collection, his tape collection, and went to work and showed me how to work the tape recorder. And then those days, it was reel to reel, and all we had were tapes beyond records, you know. And he had tapes of Scotty doing contests, you know, winning a contest like Culpepper Fiddle Contest. You know, the whole legend of Scotty was that for his Orange Blossom special, he'd go out and stand by the railroad tracks and play to the trains as they would go by. And
I've never heard that one.
Yeah, he had a version of Cluck Old Hen that was supposedly developed, you know, in Chicken Yard.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that either.
Stomping around and playing that fiddle. So, I mean, he was organic.
He was very, very special. Peter, we're talking to Peter Rowan, if you're just tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. Peter, in your opening notes on the album that we're ostensibly talking about, Carter Stanley's Eyes, you use a phrase that really intrigues me. A lot of things you say intrigue me, but you describe that where you just were talking about the tape machine and listening to, and then you kind of spent some time there and listened to the tapes of the Stanley Brothers. And your comment was you were so impressed with the generosity of the pickers and the singers. And I think that's an interesting term because I think I know what you mean by you say impressed with the generosity. But what explain that for me better because I don't want to guess at it. When you say you're listening to the Stanley Brothers and you're impressed by the generosity of the pickers and the singers, fill that in for me just a little bit.
Well, the people who were hanging around Baltimore, there was a fellow named Carl Chatsky. And these people were squatting in these old row houses. I don't think anyone was paying rent, but they were beautiful old houses that are like mansions. I don't know if you've ever seen these places in Baltimore. I don't know where they are now in the neighborhood scene. Baltimore has become such a touchstone for racial conflict and everything. I'm not sure what's going on. But in those days, these were like derelict houses and you go inside them, they were like from the, you know, the Belle Epoque golden era of architecture, urban architecture with staircases, beautiful staircases. Everything was made of wood. And so we used to have bluegrass jams over there in Baltimore in these old houses. And that's what I meant by the generosity of the players is that you were invited in. And furthermore, when I started to go out and hear local players, Their generosity was huge. You know, there was never any, like, cold shoulder or anything like that. I remember meeting Jack Cook at a local bluegrass bar in D.C. and other names, too, of people that there was a Leon Morris. A wonderful singers, guitar players, you know, they're all in their early 20s. Jack Cook had just come back from being a bluegrass boy before he hooked up with the Stanley Brothers as a bass player. And he was, you know, it wasn't like, well, so who are you? You know, you're not part of from around here. You know, it was like beyond all the regionality of, you know, the South, the North, the Mason-Dixon line, do you believe in this and that? The music was, it gave everybody a chance to be really generous because it was like, well, listen to this one. Do you like this? And, you know, Jack Cook was an early, early friend of mine and somebody who encouraged me to play guitar, you know. He had just been with Bill Monroe. So I was on my way. I didn't know it quite yet, but I was on my way to you know, be a bluegrass guitarist, be a bluegrass boy. And so meeting these folks, Don Stover was another one up in Boston. Don Stover was a banjo player who could stand in the far back of the band and project the most wonderful sound out in the room without ever needing to crowd the microphone or anything, you know. He just had the touch, you know. And I miss all these guys, but I was so fortunate to meet them all at that time and have a sense of history. And it was their generosity, really. You know, it was like, come and play one with us. It was like, what? You know, and I have to say, you know, over in Hawaii, the Hawaiian musicians that I've been hanging out with, they're the same way. There are little restaurant gigs on the, you know, on Monday night up in the country that are like the most down home. It's the same vibe as the down home vibe of bluegrass when you'd go like on a dismal, rainy Monday or Tuesday where nobody goes out and there's a crowd of 10 people in this bar and the music is heavenly. You know what I mean? And that one thing I loved about the bluegrass scene around the D.C. area, where there's the only place I could really find it at the time, was the complete respect for the music. Again, a generosity of like, well, if we're going to sing, you know, White Doves or Angel Band, you know, everybody would take the time to clarify what part they were going to sing and really do it because there was such respect for the people that were in the lead of the bluegrass world then, Bill Monroe, the Stanley Brothers, the Osborne Brothers, you know. So what we're doing, we're learning bluegrass through doing their material, but man, you give it its full due, you know. Don't just like, you know, I mean, we wouldn't stop and criticize each other, but it was like every time we'd sing one of those songs, it was like all the parts were there. In other words, everyone did their homework.
Yeah.
And it was based on singing. A lot of it was based on singing and wonderful playing, too. There were these brief moments that happened before people just go off into their own, their focus, you know.
Well, I was going to ask you that, and I don't mean to draw criticism upon any other scene today or since the time that you are discussing, but do you feel like that's still the same?
Well, it is for the people that are just jumping into it.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good distinction. Okay, yeah, yeah, you're right.
I mean, we didn't have the Berklee School of Music teaching bluegrass.
That's
that,
right.
But, yeah, it's hard to, people do always ask about, what about bluegrass today? And I would just say that people get into it because they love it. Because it's not that easy to accomplish bluegrass. I mean, a lot of it's instrumental these days. A lot of it's instrumental. I don't hear a whole lot of singing that, I mean, the singers stand out, of course, Becky Buehler and Don Rigsby, people like that. Chris Teeley, good Lord, I can't believe old Chris now heading up what used to be Prairie Home Companion.
Right, that's right.
I mean, that is without bounds, you know, and he's a young bluegrass player. So, you know, it's an ever-widening a circle of musical inspiration.
It's funny, Peter, that you mentioned Rigsby, because what I typically do when I get a new album is I put it in the car and listen. I want to get that into me before I even look at the notes, and I just want to hear it. And I want to feel it. So I'm driving down the road and I hear what comes on is "Will You Miss Me?" And I'm thinking, that's Rigsby. And I didn't even know he was on the album, and I thought, there's a voice. There's a voice you can fall behind. There's always right there strong, it was exciting. You share vocals with other people. I do not know, on the Vision of Mother, I just don't know Todd Pond.
Todd is from an old North Carolina settlement way up there, and he's just we've got to know each other over the years, and he knows all these old songs. Mm-hmm. And, to include other lead singers, it was something I just felt was just about time. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like I've been doing albums of my own material for so many years. It's got to always be original songs. Write an entire new album, just all enthusiastic and inspired to write new songs, you know, that are like old songs or new songs that are just fun to sing. And, you know, I think musical enjoyment comes from, again, it's a sense of generosity, you know, sharing in with other people's contributions and other tunes that are like Joe Val, if you remember Joe, New England mandolin player and a great singer, and he's the one who taught me Lubin Brothers style singing, and he was, I just couldn't believe, again, the amount of generosity. He'd come out every, you know, couple of times a week. I'd pick him up in my mother's station wagon and bring him out to Wayland, which is a little country town. And in the springtime, you know, we had the evening to kind of play a little bit. And he would teach me, you know, the Lubin Brothers, the Blue Sky Boys, Monroe Brothers. Not only just the let's play this tune, but he would break it down and say, no, this is actually how this part goes. He taught me Ira Lubin's harmonies because he knew, and this was when I was planning to go with Bill Monroe after a while. Joe knew that I had to know that stuff. I had to learn that stuff. And that's why the song Tiny Broken Heart is on the album, which is a wonderful, I forget who even did that now. I think they all did it, all the brother duets singing. And to sing it with Don, I get to sing the tenor part. And, you know, aside from when I had Charles Sawtelle playing with me, this is the first time that I've gotten a chance to sing some tenor, which I love. I love singing the high part.
Well, why do you think that when you say he knew that you needed to know the Leuven brothers, it wasn't just to re-sing it. What was it about needing to know and get that feel for their vocals? Do you think that's what he was saying?
Well, yeah. In two-part singing, traditionally, there was this style developed that was, instead of close harmony,
mm-hmm.
you know, the high part would kind of go up higher and create a space in there that would be called, instead of singing the third note above the melody, it would be singing the fifth note above the melody. And it's just a sound unique to the old, what they call brother style duet singing. And I think as a city billy, my tendency was to probably try and sing perfect third harmony all the time. And then also folk music, you know, folk music didn't ask you to put the, as Frank Wakefield called it, put the hurt on it. You know, bluegrass wants you to put the hurt on it.
Yeah, and, that's good. I like that.
So when you want to put the hurt on it, you got to know how to bend the note, and you got to know when to let the high part, you know, do its thing, not follow the melody completely.
Well, you do have, we're talking about the Leuven brothers, A Tiny Broken Heart is the second cut on your new album, Carter Stanley's Eyes. You wrote the first song, Drum Beats on the Watchtower, but when I read your note inside after I listened to it, that was the name was changed by Ralph. Is that right?
Ralph recorded it, and true to the genius of Ralph and the bluegrass way of looking at things, I used the name called Wild Geese Cry Again because I thought that was it is a good name.
It's a good name.
But I Hear Drum Beats on the Watchtower is the first line, and that's just very classic of especially Ralph to use the first line he's going to sing as the title.
He doesn't want to bury the lead. He wants you to know the name of the song.
It's called Drum Beats on the Watchtower.
Yeah.
Although, you know, Can't You Hear Me Calling? I was following that idea. Sweetheart of Mine, Can't You Hear Me Calling? Bill Monroe didn't call that song Sweetheart of Mine.
That's right.
Can't You Hear Me Calling?
That's right. That's on here too. Yeah. You have those, you have traditional tunes, and I still, your song, The Light in Carter Stanley's Eyes, tells such a great story. Not only is it connected to the title of the album, but that whole thing where you and Bill Monroe, and you have this visit with Carter, and there's this discussion about whether you're going to stick or not, or whether you're going to be good or not. That is so real, and it's such a great story and a great song and a great story within the song. I just think that's a wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's a true story, but you know, it took me some years to understand what was really being said there, because I mean, I didn't feel at that time that there was a torch being passed, and I still think it was more just a very casual kind of thing. Those guys were not like real wordy, you know. They were both country mountain people who, you know, there's a whole thing among country folks who, to give the short answer, you know, like the farmer in Vermont, who's standing in his field and this guy comes up in the sports car. "Excuse me, neighbor, how do I get to Portland?" He said, and the farmer just looks over there. He's standing with his shovel in his hand. He goes, "You can't get there from here." You know? Or the other guy who shows up and says, "Where's Dinkwater, Maine?" And the farmer looks at him and goes, "Don't move a damn inch." These country guys, and coming from New England, you know, we had that folklore, the mythical duo of Bert and I. It's about these fishermen that ride around in a motorboat, and it just, they're very short on what they say, but it's funny. And then, you know, you had car talk. Car talk was an extension of the old humor.
You're right.
Yeah, car talk.
You do that so well, but you're from there.
Yes, sir. I was grown up. I wasn't very streetwise. I know that. But, you know, my parents tried to give me the best education they could, you know, and I got I got
I got edumacated on on some levels that
that's Popeye talk. That's Popeye talk, by the way. Edumacated.
Yeah, I mean, I was overqualified, but my parents had raised me the same way Bill's parents had raised him, with a sense of, you know, regard for other people and showing respect. So we had that in common. And the difference between most people who went to work for Bill and I was that I was very, very curious and not afraid to ask questions. So when we would have hours on the bus, let's say, of silence mostly, somebody be driving, somebody sleeping and this and that. And, you know, after you've done 4 hours of behind the wheels of an old diesel bus like that, and the new driver jumps in the seat and you're like, it's 1 o'clock in the morning and you stagger to the back of the bus, and there's Bill Monroe. He's got his mandolin out. I mean, what am I going to do? Just go hide? No. No, it's like, this is the moment, right? I mean, it's kind of like you pinch yourself. You go, this is real. You know, it's as real as I know things can be in terms of you're in halfway in a dream state. It's late at night. You just, you know, been driving this insane vehicle that has very little brakes. And, you know, and you sit down and here's Bill Monroe and you.
You make it sound so romantic, Peter.
And Bill is like, he's like dancing along on the mandolin playing stuff he's never played on stage. Just stuff, you know. It's like, and you kind of go, you know, you do want to respect it in a way. You want to just say, oh, okay, nice, and then go to sleep or something. But I got turned on. It was the era of being turned on.
Well, it was that moment or not. You were either going to take advantage of the opportunity in that moment, don't you? I mean, don't you really have to seize those moments when they come? And I don't mean like being real forceful, but they come to you and you need to accept them.
Well, people did say to me, don't be too nosy around Bill, you know, and give him his space. You know, he's a loner. Well, I understood that, and I mean, I remember the first 2 weeks on that bus, I didn't say anything. They didn't say anything. And we just sort of drove along. But, you know, after a while, you're standing next to somebody night after night on stage, and you get a feel for that person. So Bill and I actually became friends, and we started writing this tune, The Walls of Time. And I remember asking him one night while he had finished playing he was just sort of playing. Well, you don't want to interrupt somebody when they're having that moment, you know, when they're playing their instrument. And it's like, but he said, after he played a little bit of sort of lonesome sound, he said, "Now that's the Indian people, American Indian people sound." Hmm. And so, I mean, he considered parts of his music to be black gospel, American Indian blues, and so we started chatting about that. I said, "Wow, you know," he said, "My mother knew some of that music," and I mean, I couldn't even figure the next question there, but. He did open up and say that he had spent time in New Orleans and had learned a lot there. I remember I asked him, I said, well, what did you find down there? And he just sort of smiled and said, Pete, a man could find any kind of music down there. I'm like, okay.
Well, so when he says Indian, does he mean New Orleans Indians or, you know, those, or does he mean, okay.
I mean, but it's, you know, he did this tune called Cheyenne, where the perception is that it was, you know, maybe Hank Williams did Kalijah and Bill Monroe did Cheyenne as what people at the time felt, the folklore people felt like Bill Singh had that authenticity to it. It wasn't just like, here's my version of Kalijah.
Gotcha, okay.
It was like, this is how it really goes.
I mean,
he sings some Indian part in that song.
Okay, all right.
Maybe it's from a movie. I don't know, but
or maybe it's from the Land of the Navajo.
I know. Well, that's why I never felt too odd about kind of going in that direction. You know, taking it out there on land in Navajo.
Yeah.
But I remember Bill did hear me do that one time. He was like. He was freaked out. He said, he just came up to me at Bean Blossom. He said, Pete, don't be warbling your voice, so sing it like the people, so the peoples can understand you. And yet, he didn't tell me not to.
Okay. Well.
Sing the part. He just said, refine it. I think that Bill's thing about me was, I was going in too many directions all at once. And his thing was honing, because I'm sure Bill had a lot of directions that he could have gone in, but he chose to focus this bluegrass sound in the way that we perceive bluegrass to have been, you know, and it was also the players. He began to finally freely admit that his music changed because of the players that came along.
I would think that's true, and probably you. Were you there with Bill Keith?
Bill Keith was the first person I played with up in Boston.
Okay.
Bill Keith and Jim Rooney.
Yeah,
I played
right.
mandolin for them.
Yeah.
And I was just a local guy, and Bill Keith had just come back from working with
okay, all right, I couldn't get the time straight. Okay.